Good afternoon again. Good afternoon again, everyone. I always hate this part because I know I break up great luncheon conversation and camaraderie that's going on. You know, the student sponsors are talking with students and we're all chatting, and I sort of hate to break that up, but it's going to be worthwhile this afternoon. First of all, let me start off by saying I want to thank Bob Heidrich because he is really the one who invited our speaker today. Unfortunately, Bob wasn't able to be here today to introduce Jim Rogers, and he's asked me to accept that honor for him. And so I'm going to do my best this afternoon to follow my own rules for introducing our speakers by not repeating much of what's already been outlined about him in our Forum Club newsletter. Jim was born in, wow, I've got applause already. Jim was born in Birmingham, Alabama, but grew up in Kentucky. He earned both his Bachelor of Business Administration and Juris Doctor degrees from the University of Kentucky. And after passing the bar, he began his working career as an Assistant Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Kentucky, then a Deputy Counsel for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, then into private practice before moving to the production side of the energy business. What many, Jim, as everyone does know, is the current chairman and CEO and president of Duke Energy. And prior to that, he served as chairman, CEO of Synergy before its merger with Duke. What many don't know about Jim is that he's the first in his family to attend college. Many don't know that he paid his own way through college, working nights as a newspaper reporter with limited talent, according to his boss and his editor at the time. And after working his way through undergraduate school, he put himself through law school working two jobs. In the course of his career, Jim has served on the boards of directors of 8 Fortune 500 companies, and he's currently a director of Cigna and Applied Materials. Jim is a recipient of numerous awards, and in 2009, Newsweek named him one of the 50 most powerful people in the world. But most of all, Jim is a leader. He is a very hard worker. He is smart and wise. He's the father of three, the grandfather of 11, and the husband of Marianne. Jim has testified more than 20 times before U.S. congressional committees and addressed international forums, including the United Nations General Assembly, the World Economic Forum, and the Clinton Global Initiative. All of that, with all of that, he's even managed his way through one of those hard-hitting interviews on 60 Minutes. Please join me in welcoming Jim Rogers.
Thank you. That was a fun interview. Tom, thank you very much for that introduction. You overshared. I did grow up in Kentucky. I'm very proud of that. But as many of y'all might not know, when you grow up in Kentucky, there's only three things you can do. You can coal mine, you can moonshine, or you can get on down the line. And I fall into that get on down the line category. The other thing that he didn't share with you is the reason I was working full-time at night and going to college full-time during the day is because in college I had two children. In Kentucky, you start quick. You know what I mean? I was an embarrassment to my family because my first child wasn't born in my teens. But damn close. And the other thing is, when I was in law school, and he didn't mention this, but the law school had a rule that you couldn't go to law school full time and work more than 20 hours a week in one job. So I said, well, there's no... By then, I had three children. I know, I was having a problem. And and I basically said, there's no rule against working two jobs 20 hours a week. Then I said, I think I'm going to be a good lawyer. Well, what I'm going to do this afternoon is I'm going to talk for maybe 20 to 25 minutes. And then I want to open it up to questions because I want to be a user-friendly speaker. I want to address the issues on your mind. And I want to challenge you. I've been on 60 Minutes, but I've also been on the Colbert Report. Now, I look across this room, and many of y'all have not watched that. But I'm telling you, your children and grandchildren watch that for news. But the other thing I would say to you is that I want y'all, as you sit there, I know you fill out tough questions. I have a challenge to you. I want you to bring me the toughest question you can bring me. Usually when I do speeches in front of groups like this, I hand out Starbucks card for those that ask the toughest questions. I actually do that with my employees, and they get some pretty embarrassing and tough questions. So I think the Q&A part of this is the most important, because then I address the issues on your mind. This morning, you did something amazing. My bet is you thought that it was probably pretty unremarkable what you did. You flipped a light switch. It was a simple action. It's something that you do many times during the day. I'm sure you don't think twice about when you do it. My bet is when you throw the switch, you don't go, I bet that, does that come from hydropower? Is that from nuclear? Is that from coal? My bet is you don't think anything. I don't think anything. But if the lights come on, I know exactly what you think. Damn utility. Am I right on that? I think I am. But you turn the switch and to run your coffee maker, probably this morning, your computer or your TV. But the reality is you only really think about your power once a month. And you know when that is, that's when you open your bill. And that's, you don't probably feel your best about us when you do that. Particularly down here in South Florida, price is too damn high down here. You should come further north. I can give you a lot lower price electricity. And you probably thought about electricity when you watch the Super Bowl. You know what? The good news is electricity is back of mind. It's not in the forefront. And that's okay with us. We work hard, and we think it's a tribute that you take us for granted and that we're back of mind. Because that's where we want to be. But I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to step back with you, and I'm going to do a little history. Because to get into the issues of today, you've got to know where we came from. I want you to go back in time over 100 years, back to the 1890s, 1900s, when we first started out. At that time, we were a technology company. We were the Google, the Facebook, the Microsoft of that time. What's amazing, when we started providing universal access to this country to people all across the country, at that time, we couldn't imagine what we would enable by bringing electricity to the homes and businesses across the country. We didn't envision air conditioning, refrigeration, how it would change what goes on at a hospital in terms of MRIs or X-rays. We didn't envision radio or TV or computers or the internet. We didn't invent it. We know who invented it. We just enable it. So we couldn't see over the next 100 years what we would enable. But at the end of the century, the National Academy of Engineers, and it was chaired by Neil Armstrong, basically looked back at the greatest engineering achievements of the 20th century. It wasn't sending a man to the moon. It wasn't the development of the telephone. It wasn't even the computer or the internet. But the single greatest engineering achievement of the 20th century was the electrification of America, because it enabled all these things to exist. I should tell you that Neil Armstrong spent almost a decade on my board. And to get his vote on tough issues, what I used to do is start my presentation very simply, one small step. You know, and you see, go through that period of the development of electricity. Every step of the way, we were cleaning up the environment. People don't realize that, because people have forgotten what Detroit, Chicago, Pittsburgh looked like in 1890 to 1910. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. They were burning coal in the fireplaces. I grew up in a house in Kentucky that was built in 1906. I had a fireplace in every room in that house, and when it got really cold in the wintertime, we just put a big hunk of coal in there to take the chill out of the room. People forget what it looked like. Electricity allowed us to clean up the cities in our country. And the burning of the coal was moved outside of the community. We built transmissions lines in. And then over these years, we basically continued to clean up. And then we came along and developed nuclear. And nuclear, we're the largest operator of nuclear in the world. When I ask people that question, they say, no, you can't be. France is. Well, France has 75% of their electricity comes from nuclear. But we have 104 units in this country, and we're twice as big as France, who's number two, and Japan, number three. So we have really implemented it. And for those that believe climate change is a problem, 70% of the carbon-free electricity in this country comes from nuclear. So that was a transformative technology in our business. But along the way, legislation was passed, Clean Air Act amendments. We have reduced dramatically sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, mercury, fine particulate. So we have really cleaned the environment up at the same time we produce electricity. And let me just share with you my philosophy of running a company like this. I believe it should be the philosophy for every company. I don't buy into what Jack Welch used to say in the early 80s, that there's only one purpose for a corporation. One purpose. Produce a profit. I don't believe that. What I believe is, if you're going to last decade after decade after decade, you have to run the business for all your stakeholders. Yes, you got to make money for your investors. You got to make money for those that invest in your debt. You've got to create value for your customers. You've got to create value for your employees. You've got to improve the communities that you operate in. You've got to improve the environment. It's really that stakeholder approach that creates true sustainability of an organization decade after decade after decade. And even Jack Welch recently said, you know, might have had it wrong to be all profit all the time. Maybe we need to think about the business in a broader way. The other point I would make as you think about our business is to think about what really is our mission. Our mission is to provide affordable, reliable, increasingly clean electricity in safe and sustainable ways 24/7, 365 days a year. Let me unpack that a little bit for what that means. Affordability. Actually, our rates today are the same as they were when you adjust for inflation as they were in 1992. Not many things cost the same today as they did in 1992. So affordability has been first and foremost. And I look back over 25 years, I see a lot of fads. I see a lot of trends. It's hard to distinguish the fads from the trends. But people always want us to spend more money. And as they think about the future, they don't always follow the implication for affordability. So affordability is really critical to attract investment in your community, to create jobs, to create a tax base for your community. So keeping those rates affordable is a top priority. Reliability. We provide electricity 99.99% of the time. And we're in the process of improving our grid, moving from an analog grid to a digital grid. What does that mean? Today, we don't know when power's out in a home until you call us. Can you imagine that in the 21st century? That's because we have an analog grid. So moving to a digital grid, we'll be able to identify that and reduce the outage time in the future. Increasingly clean, I talked about that. We have been on a path of cleaning up the environment in this country for a very long time. Do it in a safe way. Electricity is dangerous. Last year, we had our best safety record ever. No fatalities, best ever. And last year was a year of turmoil in our country, in our company, for a variety of reasons. We were closing a merger, and that's always an uncertain and difficult time for people. But safety is really critical. And then sustainability. To me, sustainability is very, very important. That's a word people don't understand. Sustainability to me means getting the balance right between people, profits, and the planet. To get that balance right is critical. In the same way, we have to get the balance right between providing affordable, reliable, and increasingly clean electricity. Environmentalists want me to look through the clean lens and only the clean lens. Forget reliability, forget affordability. Consumer advocates want me to look through the affordability lens, forget reliability, forget environmental issues. The reality is we have to balance all those issues in order to have a sustainable product over future years. So that is our mission going forward. Now let me quickly turn to some issues. We were talking at lunch about how you generate electricity. And coming from Kentucky, I'm going to start with coal first. About 50% of our electricity in this country comes from coal. Our operations in the Midwest, about 90% of it comes from coal because most of our plants are mine-mouth plants. Here in Florida, because we run the old Florida Progress in the northern part of the state, about 50% comes from natural gas, some from coal, but not very much. And in the Carolinas, we're about 50% nuclear and coal. Very little natural gas, although we're changing that mix. What has happened to coal is this. Everybody blames it on the regulators in Washington, and they're doing their share. But the reality is shale gas has fundamentally transformed the role of coal in the generation of electricity. Now, I have a checkered past with shale gas. When I was a consumer advocate, which was one of the first jobs I had in the Attorney General's office, I used to fight rate increases utility companies. I like the pay now and the job better. The But at that time, I can remember sitting in curtailment proceedings, allocating who's going to get the natural gas, because we had regulated natural gas since 1954. Then we started deregulating it. Then we passed a law in this country that basically said it was illegal to burn gas to generate electricity. That law was in place from 78 to 85, and then they repealed it. And we've used gas since then. And so what's happened is the shale gas, and there's a long conversation we can have about shale gas as to why it's so cheap. And it's actually a great story. It wasn't developed by the major oil companies. It was developed by independent gas producers who, when I was a lawyer, I represented. And the way they did it is they just stuck to it. Because shale gas, let me define it, is non-traditional, unconventional, usually 1 mile to 2 miles below the surface. So they took horizontal drilling that was developed in the early 80s. And the thing that people don't know is they use a technology developed by our government, the Department of Defense, during the Cold War to identify Russian subs a mile below the surface, to 2 miles below the surface. They repurposed that technology to look for oil and gas. And that's how shale gas got developed. Now, the majors are buying out all the independents. Actually, that's not a bad thing. They'll make a lot of money. They'll get to come down here with y'all. And that'll be a good thing. But the majors have the money to put it in to make sure the production is safe. You hear fracking is evil and bad from a lot of people. It's not so bad. We've been doing fracking for a very long time. But to do it in a safe way is really one of the critical things going forward. And if the majors operate it, they will do it in a safe way because they have a long-term view. They're going to be here for over 100 years. So coal is down. And for our company, by 2015, one-third of our electricity had come from coal. Before this latest acquisition we did, 70% came from coal, about one-third from coal, one-third from gas, and one-third from nuclear and renewables. To me, that's the right mix, because in investment theory says you need a portfolio. And I believe you need a portfolio of ways to generate gas, I mean electricity. And I should say this, take the transport sector. It relies only one fuel, and that's on oil, gasoline. It doesn't have any alternatives. That will change. But the reality is there's a strength. Now, both parties actually say all of the above when they talk about generating electricity. But both parties don't believe all of the above in the same way. It's the same words, but it means different things in terms of what really should be used going forward. But getting that mix right is very important, but it needs to be gotten right in the context of affordability, reliability, and clean. Let's take renewables. And we have a very large business where we produce renewables. I'm a seller of renewables, not a buyer. But the bottom line is renewables are a variable source of electricity. That intermittent source is when the wind isn't blowing, you don't get electricity with wind farms. When the sun's not shining, you don't get electricity. You need electricity 24/7. Now, there's evolution in battery technologies that's coming, but the reality is it's not here yet. But it can play an important role, but it's got to be blended in to gas. You have to have something to back it up because, again, you got to provide electricity 24/7. I'm on the board of the Nature Conservancy, and they did a study that I think is very important because they value land. And this is Physics 101. For those of y'all that want to be engineers, the basic physics says energy density matters. I can build a 1,000-megawatt nuclear plant on one-third of a square mile. To get the equal amount of kilowatt hours of energy, I have to build 40 square miles of solar panels and 200 square miles of wind. So if you care about the land, you say, well, maybe I don't need as much of that because land is scarce. And as time goes on, it becomes even more scarce. So that's just an example of how to think about coal. I've talked about shale gas. Shale gas, the biggest challenge we have is people telling us all gas all the time. Because it's cheap. It's environment. I mean, the paradigm in Washington has been, and among environmentalists and industry people, is simply this. If it's cheaper, it's got to be dirtier. Okay? If it's more expensive, it's got to be cleaner. And what shale gas has done, it's broken that paradigm. It is not only cheaper, it's cleaner when compared to coal. It has 50% of the carbon footprint of coal. And you don't have the same SOx, NOx, mercury issues that you do in the same way you do with burning coal to generate electricity. But our problem is not to get overly dependent on it. That's that all gas all the time thing. But to use it. And we have about a 100-year supply of natural gas in this country. And I've had such a checkered experience. I've been slow to believe that shale gas was the real deal. Very slow to believe that. I actually referred to it when everybody was quickly switching to gas that it was like crack cocaine for our industry. And then I realized it wasn't a perfect analogy. Because it was crack cocaine because you could go get it and produce electricity just like that. But what people have forgotten is the history of natural gas. Ben Franklin said that there are only two things in life that are certain. Death and taxes. I'd like to add a third thing. The volatility and the price of natural gas. Because even though natural gas prices today are at $3.50, they were $3.48 at MMBtu last year, they're up to about $3.80 this year. Over time, there's going to be volatility of natural gas. There's a great debate going on in the country. Should you export natural gas or keep it at home? The chemical industry, the steel industry, all are saying keep it at home and we'll build more things, we'll create more jobs. I happen to be of the school that believes that free trade is a good thing. Competition is a good thing. And actually, President Nixon was the first to say, and every president since then has said that, we need to be energy independent. And my bet is, based on BTUs imported and exported, we will be independent in another decade. Because we're exporting coal today to Europe. We're exporting coal to China. We're going to be exporting some natural gas. We export refined products. So I believe it's very important that we keep our borders open and that we have free trade. It's not free, but that's how we talk about it. But we do fair trade around the world, and that's going to put us in the strongest position over the longest time. And that's how we really, in my judgment, should really think about the natural gas issue. And at the end of the day, we're not going to export that much natural gas because there are 19 applications before DOE today. It costs billions of dollars to build a liquefaction facility. Nobody builds those liquefaction facilities without getting long-term contracts. And it's hard to enter into a long-term contract today with a producer, given the history of volatility in our industry. So I think we'll export some, but not as much as those who fear the concept of export think that we will. So coal is important, shale gas is important, nuclear is important to play a role, and there's new technologies coming along. But the interesting thing is while the Germans are shutting down nuclear, they're buying our coal. And Europe, I've gone to the World Economic Forum for about a decade, and they used to make me feel real bad. They said, your country is not doing anything about climate change. And they had thousands of pages of regulations and rules and new markets, etc. Guess what? Through the innovation, the technology, the kind of sharing of technology between the government and the private sector, we created shale gas, and our CO2 emissions are back to a 1992 level. And we haven't issued any regulations. Back to a 1992 level. And on a per capita basis, we are where we were in the 1960s. So we're marching in the right direction in cleaning up our economy. And whether you believe climate change is real or not, we're reducing our emissions footprint. And that's a good thing as we go forward in the future. The other thing that I would say is that renewables should play a role. They will play a role. And there's significant growth in them. And as I mentioned to you a moment ago, we sell, we build and sell the output from about 1,700 megawatts of renewables, which is enough electricity to basically provide electricity to over 500,000 homes in the United States. So we're in that business, and we think that there's an opportunity there. To me, the other one of those all of the above, but what should be number one, is investments in productivity gains in the use of electricity. And I'm going to kind of wrap it up with the challenges, and I'm going to do it in a Pony Express way. The challenges are this. In the 60s, growth in electricity was tied to GDP growth. 1% growth in GDP went 5% growth in demand for electricity. By the 90s, it was 1% for 1%. Today, it's 0.4% for 1% growth in GDP. I think there'll be a decoupling because the growth in electricity coming out of the Great Recession, we thought it was all recession-driven. I think it's not cyclical. I think it's structural. And I actually believe there'll be a decoupling of the demand of electricity and the growth in GDP in our economy. Some of it speaks to the nature of our economy. Some of it speaks to the fact of the great productivity gains, the new technologies, new building standards, as well as technologies that reduce usage in the home. So we are changing as an industry, and I stand here today in the same place, and I try to envision how they stood there over 100 years ago when they couldn't imagine what was to come, and I'm trying to imagine what will come. And I think as I look out, there is going to be a huge movement that's going to reduce usage of electricity in this country. It's going to require us to change our business model to make money. And that's not going to come tomorrow morning for y'all, for all of those that hold our stock. It ain't going to come in a week. It ain't going to come in a month. It's probably going to come over a decade. But I want you to know we're thinking about it. How do we change our regulatory model? How do we change our business model? How do we get prepared? All you have to do is look at the telecom industry and you look at the companies that said, no, 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 we're not embracing the future. Guess what happened to them? Roadkill. And then the companies that took the risk and embraced the future and embraced the technologies, they're the ones that are leading away and creating shareholder value. This is a company that's going to embrace the future, embrace the technology, and continue to create value. Because our company has an obligation to our shareholders. We pay out every year $2.3 billion in dividends. Think about that. I know some of y'all get it. I checked to see who was here. And y'all cash that check so damn fast. But again, I want to thank y'all for inviting me. I want to thank y'all that are here that own our stock. And you know what? Our yield is 4.5. And in this uncertain market, come to us.
Nice job.
Thank you.
Nice job. Thanks. Are we back on with this thing?
Hello. Yeah, we're
back. They only let me talk.
Yeah, we're back. Jim, thank you. What a terrific presentation. And we've got a couple mementos for you: a book of Naples and a book about Marco Island and its history and culture, to remind you of your visit here. I'll put them on your chair back here for you. And I've also got a fist full of questions. So I've tried to categorize them as best as I could. So let me get started, and I'll start off with a blue one on top, which is one of the kids, one of the students. And there were a bunch of questions, and probably the majority of questions were about cyber terrorism and what we're doing to protect the electric grid, our electricity grid, and how vulnerable it is. Have you ever been attacked? Has Duke ever been attacked by cyber hackers? And do you know who did that? Those kinds of questions.
Well, first of all, cybersecurity is the number one issue we face today. We work very closely with the government because the government has a deeper insight into the cyber issues than we do. They help us. They give us insights. And yes, we've been attacked regularly. And the ability to plant malware in your system is a huge issue. But also, we are starting to redesign our system for the future. For instance, on our generation, we just completed a $9 billion building program that's going to allow us to shut down 7,000 megawatts of old coal plants. And in that process, we created a system of digital controls, but we designed it in a way to handle cyber attack. We're redesigning and modernizing our grid to move from analog to digital to handle that, and to look for ways to island, and the Department of Defense is doing this with all facilities around the world, is to be able to create a microgrid or an island around their facilities in the event the system is actually attacked. So all you have to do is sit down. I've had the FBI at my office. I've been in briefings in Washington. And the bottom line is, this is a serious threat to our country. Equal to that is the threat of a physical attack, not on our power plants, but actually on substations and their configuration in the United States. Because if you knock out substations in a couple regions, you could knock power out for 6 months. Think about lower Manhattan with the power knocked out for 6 months, what that would do to our economy. So that is a critical issue that we're all working on.
And related to the physical attacks then, Jim, what about natural attacks, tsunamis, earthquakes, those types of things?
Well, I mean, with operations in Florida and in the Carolinas, we know a little bit about hurricanes. With operations in the Midwest, we know a whole lot about tornadoes. Here's the reality. We sent 3,000 people up to Sandy. Because within our industry, we have a tradition of when somebody's in trouble, we send people to help restore service. And the reality is our linemen love this. It's the only time they feel appreciated. The truck comes down the street, people run out, give them coffee, give them cookies, give them cake. They think it's the second coming. and they love it. But what we found in the Northeast is because they hadn't experienced those type of storms, a lot of our people sat there for days and weren't deployed because they hadn't really put in place. So we put together at our industry association a group of lessons learned so that we'll all be better prepared when they come. But the problem is, if I put everything underground, which is a lot of people suggest, it's just too expensive. But we try to build the system with enough resilience to handle it, and then we go to work to restore it when the power goes out.
Okay. Several questions on the Keystone Pipeline. Will it be built? Will the president or should the president okay the pipeline? And what are the environmental implications?
Well, first of all, the State Department's come out and said that the new proposed route is environmentally okay. I personally believe that from an environmental standpoint, the Keystone Pipeline ought to be built. Because our biggest trading partner is Canada. I'd rather buy oil from Canada than from the Middle East. It just makes sense. The other thing is from an environmental standpoint, those Canadians are going to sell that oil. They're going to build a pipeline to the coast, and then they're going to ship it to China or to Japan. And the environmental footprint of doing that is a lot bigger than putting it in a pipeline and bringing it down to the United States. So the environmentally responsible thing to do is to build it. And this thought that it is not a sound thing to do is just, in my judgment, and I ran the largest gas pipeline network in the country, is just irresponsible.
Several questions, particularly student questions about some of the renewable energy sources. Do we need to change the way we produce electricity? Are renewable methods worth their cost? And these are the students looking forward, thinking forward. What's the impact on the environment? Are you looking into other forms of electricity, such as wind and solar power? Maybe talk about that, hydro maybe. So what's the future of renewables?
We're the second largest operator of hydro in the United States. We have over 4,500 megawatts of hydro in Latin America. And 4,500 megawatts in South America, and about 75 to 80% of it's hydro. So we believe hydro is a good thing, but quite frankly, we're tapped out in America for more hydro. The second thing is, as I said, I'm in the wind and solar business. If I look out in the distance, I see that solar will trump wind. And you say, why? It will trump it because it's distributed. You put solar where the wind blows, and then you build big transmission lines, and that raises the cost. If you could put solar in the rooftop or in the neighborhood, it eliminates all the cost of getting it there. So it's cheaper. And the other thing is, and I see this being on the Board of Applied Material, they make their money by building the equipment that builds semiconductors. Intel, Samsung are their customers on that side of the business. But they're also in the solar business, and they build the equipment that makes solar panels. And their smart guys basically say, historically, the holy grail was to get solar to $1 a watt. It is at 60 cents a watt now, and there's visibility into it being 40 cents a watt. So it's coming off fast. And actually, one of the great threats to our regulatory model is the building of solar panels. And the way the rules work in 42 states in this country, if I put a solar panel, I can afford a solar panel on the roof, and I put it on the roof, then under the net metering, and this is way too technical, bottom line is I'm not charged the full cost of the transmission and distribution and the generation that stands by to serve. Those costs are reallocated to the middle class and those on fixed income and low income to pick up extra cost. That hadn't been figured out. So we have to find a way to change the regulatory structure so others are not punished for those that are rich enough to afford to put solar on their rooftop.
Two more questions. A quick one maybe, just because it's some personal interest here. Florida has a porous confinement layer. Is fracking safe here?
You know, I'm far from home, so I can pretend to be an expert.
it was law, not engineering. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm okay. Saying I don't know.
Okay.
You know, that's actually, I'm trained to say no at the right time.
Okay, several questions about global warming. And particularly one about China and how are they going to keep their electricity going to keep people working and without revolting and without hurting the environment and the costs of that environmental work that needs to be done, particularly as it relates to coal and CO2.
Well, let me quickly say, I spent a lot of time in China. We have partnerships with most of the major energy companies in China. And you say, well, Rogers, why would you do that? Because they are very similar to where we were in the 1880s in the migration from rural to urban areas. So they're building out infrastructure at warp speed, or China time, as I like to call it. And what that means is they're building 25 new nuclear plants. We're only building two in this country. We have people on those sites watching how they're building them so we can learn so that when we build nuclear, as we retire our nuclear plants in the future, we can build them cheaper and faster. So I believe for the good of the people of China and the U.S., working together to share on technologies, and I know that's a tricky area to talk about, but they are ahead of us in the deployment of many of the technologies that we're going to have to deploy. Because think about this. By 2050, we're going to retire and replace every power plant that we own in the United States today, our industry. And so to do that, we have a blank sheet of paper. The question is, what do we build and how cheaply can we build it? Because it's going to be more expensive than the fully depreciated plants that we're operating today. So if we can learn from the Chinese to build faster and smarter. On environmental, they have a larger carbon footprint than we do in the United States. I personally am of the school that believe climate's an issue. I think we have a responsibility to deal with it for future generations. I also believe that we have been given, it's been a great blessing to our country that we've found shale gas, and it's allowed us to reduce back to the 1992 level. But at the end of the day, climate change, carbon, is a global issue, not a U.S. issue, and we need to get everybody engaged in solving the problem. It doesn't do any good for us to solve the problem if China's not solving the problem. But anybody that saw the pictures this winter of China, where you couldn't picture, I wasn't there then, but you couldn't, the sun actually shines when I'm there. It's actually my people in Beijing say, come more often. But you couldn't see your hand in front of you. And that's from those coal plants. That's from the industrial output, because they have not retrofitted those plants the way we have in the U.S. to reduce that emissions.
Jim, thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I leave one comment?
Jim's, he's got one more comment here.
Jim? Let me leave y'all with one thought. And I think this is a very important thought, and it's probably even more important for the students that are here today. What's missing in corporate America, what's missing in our government, is the ability to have a long-term view. And what I'm suggesting is, in our industry specifically, most capital intensive, we build power plants for 40 to 60 years, so we have to have a long-term view. I believe that we need to embrace what I call cathedral thinking. Take a minute and tell you how I thought through this. When my grandchildren reach a certain age, I mean, my granddaughters reach 10, I take them to London and to France or Paris. And we go to Notre Dame, and the guide tells us all about Notre Dame. It was built over three or four generations. And you think about building a cathedral over three or four generations. And the architect who designed it never saw it finished. The people that worked on the foundation never saw the walls or the stained glass windows. Those that worked on the walls and the stained glass windows never saw the spires. And even those who saw it finished never saw all the marriages, the funerals, the prayers that came for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years after the building of it. We need a vision. We need the faith. And we need to leave it better for the next generation, because we need to keep building. I don't know where we are in that cathedral in America. Are we on the walls or in the foundation? But wherever we are, we need to finish it so that the next generation can take us to a higher level. And that takes vision, stick-to-itiveness, and faith. So go home. If you heard anything from me other than that kind of stuff about Kentucky, take home this idea of cathedral thinking. And one last point, we need to do that kind of thinking on China time. Thank you all very much.
We'll see you all in 2 weeks.